the smallest enclaves of Central America and the Caribbean, and is available on SoundCloud, iTunes Podcast, and Google Play Music. The Latino Media Collective is recorded in WPFW Studios and airs Fridays at 1 p.m. on WPFW Washington.
Welcome, listeners, to WPFW 89.3 FM, WPFWFM.org. In this hour, we the people, I'm your host, David Whetstone, and I am so happy that you, the listener, decide to sponsor this station. You've done so for 46 years, providing jazz and justice. And we're going to follow those lines in this broadcast. Our subject today is the Arc of Truth in the life and thinking of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Our guest is cultural historian Louis V. Baldwin. Dr. Baldwin is professor emeritus of religious studies at Vanderbilt University, which is in Nashville, Tennessee. He is the author of There is a Bomb in Gilead, The Cultural Roots of Martin Luther King Jr., To Make the Wounded Whole, The Cultural Legacy of Martin Luther King Jr., and Never to Leave Us Alone, The Prologue of Luther King Jr., followed by his latest book, The Arc of Truth, The Thinking of Martin Luther King Jr. Dr. Baldwin has spent most of his adult life being a King scholar, and he's well known in religious study circle for a degree of expertise that is totally unique. Dr. Baldwin, good morning, and thank you for being with us this morning. How are you, sir?
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Well, we should get right to it. It's such an honor to have you here with us this morning. Can you first begin to tell the listeners how you decided to dedicate most of your work in life to the study of Dr. King?
Well, I guess when I started seminary back in the early 70s, I had had some exposure to the civil rights movement in high school, college. And during my seminary years, I had a course on the life and thought of Martin Luther King Jr. I was at Colgate Rochester Divinity School, Bexley Hall Crozer Seminary at that time, 1971 to 75. And I had a course on Dr. King and, of course, a number of courses on the social gospel. And that reinforced my interest in Dr. King. So after I finished seminary, I matriculated at Northwestern University in Evanston, Illinois. I pursued a PhD in American Religious Studies, and my interest in Dr. King grew. And it was during my pursuit of the PhD degree that I decided to write articles on Dr. King. And from that point, after receiving the PhD in 1980, I decided to devote my life to King studies and King scholarship.
I don't want to waste a minute to spare, to be quite honest. So we're talking about a particular aspect of Dr. King that I believe most scholars in the public square neglect, and that is the matter of truth. And I would like you to give at least a preliminary definition or finding of how you got the concern of truth with Dr. King.
Well, Dr. King understood truth as a legitimate extension of the facts and of reality. And we know that he grew up in a household in Atlanta, Georgia, and in a church tradition that attached supreme value to truth, truth telling, and truth sharing. Dr. King's father, as you well know, Martin Luther King Sr., was a pastor of Ebenezer Baptist Church in Atlanta. And he proclaimed truth from the pulpit and acted on truth daily in terms of his involvement in the struggle against segregation. So Dr. King grew up in that kind of environment, a church tradition, an extended family tradition in which truth was considered a supreme value. And he also grew up with a questioning attitude toward life. We have to remember that he grew up in the midst of a Jim Crow culture. And he was always raising questions about why such a social order. And he was told by his parents when he was still in elementary school that segregation was a social order, but not a natural order. But he said from that point, from about age six on, he had this questioning attitude toward life, and he was determined to know truth.
Your book informs us, and you said it just now, that his family life reinforced this commitment, this conviction.
Uh-huh.
Martin Luther King Sr., sometimes probably known as Daddy King, pastor of Ebenezer Baptist Church, was no shrinking violet in Atlanta in a time where there was
fierce and ferocious oppression.
Yeah.
If I'm recollecting correctly from your book,
mm-hmm.
he witnessed his father even chastising a policeman not to call him boy.
Yes.
And his father, along with his maternal grandfather, were involved in various black civic organizations throughout the Atlanta area, including
yes.
the NAACP.
Yeah.
Could you say just even a little bit more about this kind of early formative experience of Dr. King?
Well, I think we have to keep in mind his education. We've talked about family and the church tradition. But in the very early years in elementary school at Yonge Street Elementary School in Atlanta, Dr. King was exposed to a number of preachers and teachers who stressed the importance of truth and truth-telling. Truth-telling about black history, truth-telling about life and what it meant to grow up in a segregated or Jim Crow society. So he had teachers, and he was surrounded by preachers and other success symbols that talked to him constantly about truth and truth-telling. So you have to take into account his early education. When he got to Morehouse at age 15 in 1944, one of the administrators at Morehouse described Dr. King as an avid truth seeker. And of course, he was in his teens at that time. So education was important. The family, church tradition were very, very important. And I think we have to take into account experiential factors. The fact that he was exposed to brutal oppression in the South. And that too triggered the same kinds of concerns on his part as they related to this pursuit of truth.
So you're clearly demonstrating that he extended an unafraid, unabashed, even I would dare say rightful nature of inquiry, unafraid mm-hmm. to ask questions in Sunday school,
yeah.
unafraid to ask questions throughout his early education, unafraid once he gets to college.
Yeah.
The book seems to indicate, as well as other scholars have, that this proclivity of asking questions kind of marked Dr. King as, let's use a fancy term, a dialectical thinker. In other words, the purpose of asking a question was indeed to seek the truth.
That's right.
Again, help us out as listeners, Dr. Baldwin. What's a preliminary or functioning sense of the truth that you want us to keep in mind?
Well, truth as absolute. Dr. King had in mind objective truths, truths that are universally acceptable, that are verifiable. He often said that God is absolute truth, and that there are certain objective truths that we have to accept because they are universal, they are verifiable. So that's very, very important. But we know that he spoke of different kinds of truths, experiential truths, biblical truths, theological truths, philosophical truths. So he understood that there are different categories of truth, but truth is truth. It is the legitimate extension of the facts and of reality. This is how we understand truth.
It's said that he looked anywhere and everywhere, not willy-nilly, not in terms of itching ears or anxiousness, but a deliberate discipline practice of his life.
Mm-hmm.
Is it, I'm trying to be a little bit careful here, but you and other scholars have talked about a sense of King's rejection of biblical fundamentalism. What's meant by that?
Yes, well, Dr. King was exposed very early, as you well know, to what he called unlettered teachers who were fundamentalists, biblical fundamentalists, and of course his own parents were biblical fundamentalists. But given his early questioning attitude toward life, he was uncomfortable with biblical fundamentalism. When he denied the physical resurrection of Jesus at 12 years old, he said, "I shocked my Sunday school class." But I think that speaks to this questioning attitude toward life. The physical resurrection of a person did not make sense to him. And of course, he raised the question in that context, does it really make sense? And we see him even at age 12 struggling with biblical truths. And later, of course, he, at age 18, when he was before his ordination committee, becoming a preacher at that time, he denied the virgin birth. So he had problems with certain biblical fundamentals, the physical resurrection of Jesus, the virgin birth, a literal hell during those early years. And this is why when he left Morehouse, he had pretty much rejected fundamentalism in favor of theological liberalism and biblical liberalism.
So that branch of theology is known to be very analytical and very critical in a scholarly sense.
Well, and
you go ahead, sir.
Well, Dr. King considered philosophical theology as the best path to truth. As you well know, his PhD was in systematic theology, but he also claimed philosophical theology because the philosophical life, he felt, was very important. So is the theological life when one is interested in the pursuit of truth. And this is why he very early had an interest in both philosophy and theology. But before that, he majored in sociology at Morehouse. And as you well know, social science methodology is about what? Collecting facts and data to establish truths about human affairs. So you can see throughout those early years, Morehouse, later Crows of Boston, he's studying sociology, he's studying philosophy and theology because he realizes that these are paths to truth.
So people with this gem of knowledge know that for Dr. King, in many regards, it all started with Plato.
Yes.
And you talk about some of his affinities. Who were the people? What was the thought that he was engaging?
Well, he felt that Plato had come up with certain truths about the love ethic, for an example. Based on Plato's dialogue, King had come to the idea of love as eros, romantic love, love as philia, brotherly love, and agape love, as you well know, which is the highest form of love, unconditional love for all people. So he felt that Plato, Aristotle, Socrates, all of these early philosophers were interested in not only getting at reality, but also understanding truth. What is truth? And it is the highest good, according to these earliest philosophers, as Dr. King understood them. So he not only studied now the early Greek philosophers, but also the ancient Hebrew prophets, as you well know, because he felt that in the case of both the philosophers and the prophets, the goal was to understand truth, to pursue truth, and to understand truth. Not to come to some final understanding of truth, because the understanding of that King had is that this is an endless search. But he began that search with a study of the ancient Greek philosophers and the ancient Hebrew prophets.
And just to fill out the picture, let me first reintroduce you and help our listeners get our bearings. Talking about the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Our guest this morning is cultural historian Louis B. Baldwin. Dr. Baldwin is professor emeritus of religious studies at Vanderbilt University. He is the author of There is a Bomb in Gilead, The Cultural Roots of Martin Luther King Jr., To Make the Wounded Whole, The Cultural Legacy of Martin Luther King Jr., Never to Leave Us Alone, The Prayer Life of Martin Luther King Jr., and the recently released, The Arc of Truth, The Thinking of Martin Luther King. That is our topic of discussion. Dr. Baldwin has said, Martin Luther King Jr. said and wrote as much or more about the meaning, nature, power of truth than any other prominent figure in the 1950s and the 1960s. King was not only vastly influential as an advocate for and a defender of truth, he also did more than anyone in his time to organize truth into a movement for liberation, uplift, and empowerment of humanity. efforts that ultimately resulted in the loss of his life. Mm-hmm. Dr. Bowen, you further continued and said that truth derives from a revolution in the heart, mind, and soul before it can be translated into institutions and structures that guarantee freedom, justice, human dignity, equality of opportunity, and peace.
Yes, sir.
And so now the listeners know what we're about in this hour. Thank you, sir.
Yes, sir. Yes.
Let's, you know, it's a shame to sometimes be so linear in a discussion, but yeah. I want to get as much from you for the benefit of our listeners as possible. Let's remember Dr. King's other inspirations, not only the Hebrew prophets and Jesus, but Thoreau and Gandhi. Can you tell us about the last two in particular?
Yes. Dr. King actually studied Jesus before he studied Gandhi and Thoreau. And he found much in Gandhi and Thoreau that sort of reinforced what he had gotten from his study of Jesus. He read the Sermon on the Mount, the Beatitudes, the fifth chapter of St. Matthew, love your enemies, turn the other cheek. But when he got to Thoreau, he got a philosophical understanding of what that meant. And also with Gandhi, because both speak of the love ethic. In fact, Dr. King claims that its first intellectual contact with nonviolence came through his reading of Henry David Thoreau, and later Gandhi, of course. But we have to understand that he first read Jesus. And because of what he had gotten from his reading of Jesus, about Jesus in the New Testament, he was receptive to what he got from Thoreau and Gandhi around this question of what is love and how to translate love into nonviolent action. And Gandhi and Thoreau taught him a lot about that, how to actually translate the love ethic into nonviolent action, civil disobedience, acts of civil disobedience, etc. So this is very, very important.
And I was intrigued by your exploration and examination of the Gandhi interest, particularly around the notions of truth. Can you just convey what a reader of your book might find out about that?
About Gandhi?
Yes, and particularly the notion of truth as King studied Gandhi.
Well, we have to look at Gandhi's concept of satyagraha, which means truth is equal love, force, or justice. So you have to draw that connection between truth, love, and justice. And Dr. King, as the same as Gandhi, said that there's an interrelationship here that we have to take into account. In other words, there is an intimate relationship between truth, love, power, justice. Love, power, and justice are dimensions of truth, dimensions of the activity of truth, if I might put it that way. They are also attributes of God. Dr. King made it clear that when he spoke of love, power, justice, that he was actually talking about attributes of God and also dimensions of the activity of God.
You have said in your book, and I think I've heard somewhere, that for Martin Luther King, love, power, and justice are a creative union.
Mm-hmm.
So power at its best is love implementing the demands of justice.
Yeah. And love at its best is justice at its best is love speaking against anything that stands against love. So here again, and we have to take into account the impact of Paul Tillich there too, because the philosophical theologian Paul Tillich has written a book called Love, Power, and Justice. And Dr. King had read that book. And he understood that you really can't separate the three, that there's a creative union there, that love, power, and justice are expressions of the activity of God, and you can't separate the three.
With that in mind, I'm going to reintroduce you and signal to our control room that we'll probably take an earlier than normal break for our public service announcements.
Okay.
So let me do the bridge here and tell listeners, if you stick with We the People right here on your Jazz and Justice radio station, WPFW 89.3 FM. You're going to find out how Dr. King took his pursuit of truth with an active dynamic life and affected the world outside the bounds of the church, outside of the parameters that have historically evolved and have limited him. And so on this occasion, we not only celebrate Dr. King, but we thank Dr. Lewis Baldwin, who's the cultural historian who's written The Arc of Truth, for his good work. Dr. Baldwin, you are very adroit in your writing. You gave us a bridge, and I'll just use it here. Only a few months after receiving his PhD, he, Dr. King, was launched into civil rights leadership in December of 1955. And so we'll continue from that point onward. I'm going to ask listeners to stick with us. You're listening to WPFW 89.3 FM, WPFWFM.org. The program is We the People, and we'll be right back after these announcements. And sincerely and with a heartfelt conviction of thanking you for keeping such a station as WPFW in existence, both by your financial wherewithal, but also with your social connectivity and supporting us. We're here with Dr. Lewis V. Baldwin. He is a King scholar, pretty well known in the field, sir. Thank you. You've done some hard work over many, many years.
Thank you, sir.
And we're focusing our conversation through the subject of his book, The Arc of Truth, The Thinking of Martin Luther King Jr. As I said before the break, we really can confirm King's commitment and meaningful pursuit of the truth by talking about his public life. Mm-hmm. And I made the bridge to December 1955. What's beginning to happen with Dr. King? Again, he's freshly PhD'd. He's got his doctorate.
Mm-hmm.
Where is he going to? What responsibilities does he take up? And what does he encounter, sir?
Well, we know that in December 1955, by that time, Dr. King had preached a lot about truth. He had written about truth, but when Rosa Parks refused to give up her seat, he was catapulted to leadership in the Montgomery movement. And at that point, he said, I had to learn how to translate the truths I'd learned in the philosophies and universities and seminaries into practical action and practical reality. And he was able to do that through the civil rights movement. He saw the civil rights movement from the very beginning in Montgomery as going to battle for truth. He often talked about truth marching on, which meant, of course, that the civil rights movement was about living truth and acting on truth, not simply exposing the truth about America, but also advancing certain truths. Truths about what America should become, calling America back to her declaration of self-evident truths in the Constitution and Declaration of Independence. So at that point, he had, in Montgomery, had become not simply a proclaimer of truth, but one who had begun to act on truth. Through civil disobedience and nonviolence and boycotts, other forms of nonviolent direct action.
But there's a price to that, and sometimes you pay the price in a quiet place.
Mm-hmm.
I'm alluding to, and you were smiling, he had a kitchen table experience in the middle of the night.
That's right.
What was this kitchen table experience?
Well, he received a call at midnight one night, I think it was January 1956. He received a call from a white supremacist who threatened his life, telephone call, threatened his life, threatened to blow up his home, threatened his family. And he said for the first time, he felt deep fear. He didn't know what to do. He thought about all of the philosophy and theology he had studied in the universities and seminaries, trying to come up with philosophical and theological reasons for evil, some understanding of that kind of evil. But he said the answer didn't come at that point from philosophy and theology. And then he bowed over a cup of coffee and said a prayer. And he said he prayed to God for courage in the face of bigotry and intolerance and racism. And he said he had a vision as a result of that prayer. And the Holy Spirit came to him and said, look, keep standing up for justice and for truth. And lo, I will be with you even until the end of the world. It was an epiphany. It was a vision, a religious experience, something of a conversion experience. And I think it was at that point that Dr. King understood his role as a prophet, that he had to stand up for truth in spite of the risk, even at the risk of his life. And so from that point, from that the time of that vision in the kitchen in 1956, he said, I had no longer experienced that kind of fear, because I always had this sense of divine companionship, that God was with us in the movement, that God would stand with us in the movement. And God, after all, is the source of all truth, all courage. So I had no reason after that kitchen experience to really fear, not even to fear death.
You say in your narrative at this juncture, you take the choosing of describing Dr. King as the ethical prophet.
Yeah.
And as a reader of your book, there was a gladness of heart at your strong affirmation. So yeah. If you can tell the listeners why this notion of the ethical prophet, particularly since we've introduced it by way of the kitchen table experience, why is it so critical in a good understanding, a good comprehension of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.?
We have to understand, now go back to the Bible, because Dr. King saw himself standing in the tradition of the Old Testament prophets, or the Hebrew Bible prophets, Amos, Hosea, Isaiah, who were mouthpieces for God. They told God's truths to the people. And Dr. King saw himself in that light, standing in that prophetic tradition that extends back to the Hebrew Bible or the Old Testament, also that prophetic tradition that extends back in the Black church tradition, with figures like Richard Allen and Frederick Douglass and Harriet Tubman, Sojourner Truth. He was a part of that prophetic tradition as well. And if you're going to be an ethical prophet, you have to be willing to speak truth to power and evil in high places. You have to understand the moral obligation to speak truth to power. And this is what an ethical prophet is. This is what an ethical prophet does. Dr. King said, and we see this in his outspokenness on Vietnam. Many of his co-workers and many in his family had said, look, if you take on this issue, it's very dangerous. You could be assassinated. But Dr. King nonetheless decided that he would speak out against U.S. involvement in Vietnam. He would attack capitalism. He would call for a radical redistribution of economic resources in the interests of the poor. And all of this is revolutionary. But the ethical prophet must speak truth to power and must take on all social evils, irrespective of the threats to his well-being and his life.
So as you've demonstrated in your book, truth and freedom are inseparable in King's own scales of values.
Yeah.
When we get to preaching, he preached, ye shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free, John 8, verse 32. One of his favorite verses, I believe.
Yeah.
So, in one regard, there is an open license, most of King's life, an open sense of support from people who look like him.
Yeah.
Within the doors of the church and the various communities that he was involved in. But by his very nature, he's challenging America. What was King's message strategy?
King's message strategy was to speak to the evils of society to expose those evils and to call America back to her democratic creed, to say to America, be true to what you said on paper, be true to what you said in the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution. He had the Bible in one hand and the Constitution in the other. And he called upon America to be true to both. You say that you stand in the democratic tradition. Be true to what you said in your founding documents. You say that you are part of Judeo-Christian culture. Be true to what you say when you quote scripture. So that was Dr. King's messaging strategy. I think it is reflected very well in the letter from the Birmingham City Jail, where he challenges America to really be true to her democratic creed and her Judeo-Christian creed. And I think that was essentially his messaging strategy.
Without any dilution, I just want to strategically reiterate at your prompting that the important triad of extra-biblical documents were the Declaration of Independence, the Constitution, and the Emancipation Proclamation.
Yeah.
Throughout his speeches, it is would do one well to note those times where he draws on those documents.
Yeah.
I want to deliberately utilize the whole hour, but I want to say at this point in our progression, he's talking to the broadest audiences while challenging white Christians to take what he's doing, his being, the activities around him deeply and seriously. There's a striking contrast of those who make a religious claim who are against them and Dr. King's wonderful, eclectic global internationalism. We've already demonstrated that he was well aware of Gandhi and other traditions. Mm-hmm. Rabbi Abraham Joshua Heschel marched with him. Other notable leaders did too as well. Can you talk a little bit about the challenge to white Christians, but also maybe dare to compare or contrast that to the response of the religious community at large?
Yes, Dr. King said to white Christians, and we see this in the letter from the Birmingham City Jail, that you need to go back to a sense of the prophetic as reflected in the early church. The early Christians would not go to war. They would not bow down to Caesar. They would not accept the status quo. They would not worship the status quo. So he called upon white Christians to go back to the principles that you say you hold dear, scripture. You say that you are part of the Bible Belt here in the South. What does the Bible say to us about love and justice and freedom? We need to go back to those concepts, he said to white Christians. And I think that was his message to the Christian community as a whole, to the Christian world, is that we need to be clear about what Christianity means, that love is central to the Christian faith, that Jesus said over and over that we should love our neighbor as ourselves, that we should love God, that we can't love God unless we first love the neighbor. So he was calling all Christians back to a sense of what the gospel is, what the true gospel is, the gospel of love, the gospel of peace, the gospel of reconciliation, forgiveness, and community. This is what I think his challenge to all Christians was about. And we have to keep in mind, you mentioned Rabbi Heschel and Mohandas K. Gandhi. Dr. King believed in pan-religious dialogue. He believed that truths are conveyed through all religions to some extent. And so he felt that learning about other religions provided an opportunity for growth from him, for him. That when we study other religions, they provide opportunities for learning, for growth, also for cooperative concrete activism in the interest of human liberation and empowerment. And we know that Dr. King and the Civil Rights Movement intersected Protestants and Catholics and Jews, all marching for freedom, for the same goal. They are different. They have different belief systems in some sense. But this common goal of human liberation and empowerment. So he called for pan-religious dialogue and also pan-religious cooperation. Cooperation between Christians, but also between Christians and peoples of other faith traditions. That we all have to work together if we're going to have a world that's peaceful, if we're going to have a world in which people are respected for their personhood, human dignity, community, reconciliation. All of these values are important, and we must pursue them through pan-religious cooperation.
And it's no contradiction that in operating within his own identity, his own tradition, the cross, its event, and its actuality became increasingly significant for Dr. King, both symbolically and literally. Mm-hmm. And, you say that in your book.
Yeah.
What did the cross symbolize regarding truth for Dr. King?
Well, Dr. King talked a lot about bearing the cross of truth. And he saw Christ on the cross as bearing the cross of truth. But through the resurrection, Christ what? Shows the triumphant quality of truth. The resurrection is about truth triumphing over untruth.
So both the truth crucified and the truth victorious, as you say in your book.
Yes, yes. The cross is both a truth carried, a truth on the shoulders of the prophet, as well as truth ultimately becoming triumphant over untruth. And that has to be kept in mind. So Dr. King spoke of the cross in symbolic terms and also in literal terms. He went back to the Bible, talked a lot about Jesus bearing the cross and what that meant, but also in more symbolic terms, what that cross means for all human beings who are willing to be truthful, to engage in truth telling and truth sharing. That cross has a meaning for us all.
The ultimate demonstration of love in action.
That's right. Yeah. That's right. It's the ultimate demonstration of what love is, what justice is, what truth is. And that's very, very important.
With this conviction and his determination to spread that and have other people take it up, he urged people to become the maladjusted. What is meant by being the maladjusted?
Well, Dr. King said maladjusted is a word that psychologists use to show, to describe people who don't adjust socially to society. But he said, I don't want to adjust to segregation. There's certain things I don't want to adjust to. I want to remain maladjusted to. I don't want to ever adjust to economic injustice. I want to remain maladjusted. And a word he used also interchangeably with that is nonconformity, is what he was talking about. I don't ever want to conform to the status quo as it relates to racial injustice and economic injustice and war. I want to remain maladjusted. I want to be a nonconformist, because you don't adjust to evil. You remain maladjusted in the face of evil. You remain a nonconformist in the face of evil. Jesus, he said, was maladjusted. He was a nonconformist. He refused to bow to Caesar. He refused to support war. He refused to sanction hatred and bigotry. He remained maladjusted or a nonconformist in that regard.
You are a very skillful user of quotes. If you allow me, this will kind of further the point and push us forward. Mm-hmm. You quote Dr. King, history still has a choice place for those who have the moral courage to be maladjusted.
Yeah.
The salvation of the whole world lies in the hands of the maladjusted. The challenge to be maladjusted, as maladjusted as the prophet Amos,
yeah,
who in the midst of the injustices of his day would cry out in the words that echoed across centuries, let judgment run down like waters and righteousness like a mighty stream. Martin Luther King in the essay, The Cause of the Maladjusted, 1956. Mm-hmm. So very early in his particular juncture, in his particular journey, again, he's spreading his conviction, his commitment, and his solidarity with other human beings throughout the world.
Yeah.
Listeners, I'm going to remind you that we're talking with Dr. Louis V. Baldwin. Dr. Baldwin is a King Scholar and cultural historian of American religion. His latest book is The Ark of Truth, and it's subtitle, The Thinking of Martin Luther King Jr. That is the engine of our conversation. Mm-hmm. Dr. Baldwin, thank you again for being so much with us.
Thank you.
You make our programming special in our commemoration of Dr. King. I'm going to finish up my house duties here with the station and say, listeners, it's because you, the listener, have supported this station. Every time you go to WPFWFM.org, click that red donate button, you empower a terrific array of programming that supports jazz and justice for well over 46 years. I'll give you one example and we'll get back to our conversation. At 1 p.m. today, Eastern Time, Africa Now with host Moise. Every noontime, we give you the jazz or music part of things by having you not forget the blues. Don't forget the blues. It's my pleasure to always introduce Clarence the Blues Man Turner, who immediately follows the news after this program. All that and more. I thank you, listeners, for supporting this station for over 46 years. Dr. Baldwin, two charges. I am going to limit myself because we really want to hear two concerns from you. Mm-hmm. I'll start by saying that you've made it clear that Dr. King's courage and commitments and work cost him dearly. We've referred people to the speech regarding the war in Vietnam at Riverside Church a year before his assassination. Yeah. We've referred from the letter from the Birmingham City Jail. Mm-hmm. We'll probably mention in some way his address regarding the Memphis sanitation worker strike.
Yes.
And his sermon there. Mm-hmm. So I will compress the question because we'll have about 5 minutes or so mm-hmm. at best. Movements advance truth. That's what King was about. He was assaulted on all fronts, mass media, white supremacists, government officials, and the like.
Mm-hmm.
I would be wrong if I didn't leave you and ask, what is it in this moment that you want us to draw upon in the work and life of Dr. King? It's just that simple a question.
Yes. I would want people to understand as they read this book and think of Dr. King that truth matters. And that's important in the culture in which we live today because we are rapidly becoming an anti-truth-telling culture. And Dr. King reminds us that truth always matters. We have to get back to truth-telling and truth-sharing. If we're going to survive on a solid moral and spiritual foundation as a society, if we're going to remain a civilized society, if we're going to model what a civilized society means, we got to get back to a truth-telling culture. Many scholars are saying today that we live in a post-truth age where lying occurs routinely, that lying has become the norm and not simply a deviation from the norm. So Dr. King reminds us that we have to have the kind of values-laden culture that encourages, that not only encourages and cherishes truth and truth-telling, but that demands truth and truth-telling. And this is what I would hope that readers would get from the book. This is what I would hope that we will understand as we remember Dr. King on what would have been his 94th birthday, is that truth matters. And if we don't have truth and we don't have truth telling and truth sharing in our society, then we cease to exist on a solid foundation of moral and spiritual values.
Indeed. Would you say that Dr. King would support many of the different efforts that are going on that are indeed inclusive, ecumenical,
yes,
and such?
I think Dr. King would be very much in support of anything that's ecumenical, pan-religious in focus, because he felt that all people of all faith traditions have something to contribute to a better world, to a more peaceful world, to bringing about not only world peace, but world community.
And Dr. Lewis V. Baldwin, with your book, The Arc of Truth, The Thinking of Martin Luther King, thank you for really lifting up this important aspect of Dr. King. No longer does he get defanged by the progression of time, but he must be upheld as you have done such. I want to publicly thank you not only for being with us in this hour, but a lot of good, hard, hearty work.
You've
expended with most of your life, I dare say, in us appreciating Dr. King and truth seeking, truth telling, and truth sharing are not passive things. Nonviolence is not passive. It's love in action.
That's right.
And I just wanted to reiterate those points to demonstrate, at least in this hour, I've been a decent student of what you've been saying. Thank you, sir. And I'm sure my listeners thank you.
Thank you for your great questions. They were great questions.
Okay.
Great questions.
All the best to you, sir.
Thank you.
Again, Dr. Lewis V. Baldwin, his book is The Arc of Truth, The Thinking of Martin Luther King Jr.
Yes. And Happy New Year to you.
Yes, thank you. My deep, deep thanks and appreciation, particularly in this show, for the engineering talents and actions of Mike Nasella. It's very much appreciated, along with my thanks to the News and Public Affairs Department of WPFW, to fellow programmers and staff, thank you. And most importantly, you, the listener, thank you for supporting not only this hour, but those things that delight and empower you, that we build a better world one broadcast at a time, serving the collective need and imagination of you, the community. Thank you. Coming up next is the news, I believe, and hopefully we'll meet again on the radio. Take good care in the meantime.
Remember Freestyle Union from back in the 90s in DC? Or if you ever heard jazz legend Steve Coleman playing with a virtuoso rapper? Or if you've just been keeping up with what's going on in the DMV right now, then you know the artist that is Kokai. One of DC's most original talents, an author, improviser, storyteller, and 2023 Guggenheim Fellow, Kokai comes to Songbird Music House on April 28th for a special concert with his live band presented by Capital Bop. That's Sunday, April 28th. At Songbird in Northeast DC. Also on the bill is Baltimore's Conjure Collective, a new group you won't want to miss. Info at capitalbop.com. That's CAPITALBOP.com.
The best in live music entertainment is coming this spring to Bethesda Theater. Let's welcome music royalty, The Whispers, performing all their classic songs for two big shows on Friday, April 26th at 8:30 p.m. and again on Saturday, April 27th at 8 p.m. Also coming is Trouble Funk, featuring go-go legend Big Tony, celebrating his birthday by performing all their go-go classics on Friday, May 3rd at 9 p.m. And on Mother's Day, it's Howard Hewitt performing his own popular songs and those by Shalamar for two shows on Sunday, May 12th at 3 p.m. and 7 p.m. The Whisperers on April 26th and 27th, Trouble Funk featuring Big Tony on May 3rd, and Howard Hewitt on Mother's Day, May 12th. Get more information on all shows at BethesdaTheater.com. WPFW is a proud media partner with Bethesda Theater.
From WPFW News in Washington, I'm Sue Goodwin. Today is Wednesday, April 24th. Here are some headlines. The Supreme Court is taking up a high-stakes abortion rights case today on whether hospitals have an obligation to provide abortions to women who are in medical emergencies. The justices are hearing arguments on whether federal law requires emergency room physicians in Idaho to perform abortions to stabilize pregnant patients experiencing a medical crisis. The state's near-total prohibition on the procedure only allows doctors to end a pregnancy to save a woman's life and makes no exceptions if only her health is in grave danger. While a ruling in the case will only apply to Idaho hospitals, it could set a precedent for more than 20 other states with near-total bans on abortion, particularly the five other states that only allow abortions to save the mother's life and have no health exception. The court is expected to deliver rulings on this case and another on medication abortion by late June. President Biden today signed a $95 billion foreign aid bill passed by the Senate last night after months of debate. It includes $61 billion for Ukraine, $15 billion in military aid for Israel, $9 billion in humanitarian aid for Gaza and other war-torn areas, and $8 billion in security assistance to deter Chinese aggression in the Indo-Pacific. The legislation also includes language to force the Chinese owner of TikTok to divest from the popular app or otherwise face a ban within the United States. The White House had for months pleaded with lawmakers to approve the additional aid for Ukraine, in particular as it fights against Russian aggression, but some conservative Republicans had pushed back against providing the additional aid. The Justice Department announced yesterday it will pay nearly $130 million to victims of former Team USA gymnastics doctor Larry Nassar. The payment settles legal claims brought over the department's failure to investigate allegations that could have brought the convicted child molester to justice sooner and prevented dozens of assaults. Nassar is serving multiple sentences related to child pornography and sexually abusing women and girls under his care. The FBI acknowledged it mishandled the sexual abuse complaints throughout 2015 and 2016. And nearly 40% of people in the United States live in areas with unhealthy levels of air pollution, and the country is backsliding on clean air progress as the effects of climate change increase, according to a new report released today from the American Lung Association. Their latest State of the Air report shows that between 2020 and 2022, 131 million people were exposed to unhealthy air quality. That's almost 12 million more since the last survey a year ago. The data also showed that people of color are more than twice as likely than their white counterparts to live in communities with poor air quality. Extreme heat, drought and wildfires are among the factors that have contributed to the increase in deadly air pollution, especially in the western part of the country. And in weather today, it is 70 degrees.